Hi, everyone. My name is Jim Shaw, and I'm an alcoholic. And because God's been good to me, it's not been necessary, nor have I had anything to drink, shoot, snort, or anything else since June 27, 1966. And for this period of time, I'm extremely grateful. We do that down in Norman, you know. We tell our sobriety date. I know that don't do it back here, but you know, if I get out of practice, I might forget it back there, and they'll remind me, so I'm doing it here. Fulmer, I think that's wonderful. I was glad you said something about the accents, because I was going to say that, ask any of you if you thought that speaker this morning and some of these other folks got up here talked a little funny. I didn't know for sure if that was just me or if it was really true, but you betcha. And, of course, my roots are Southern. My dad was born in Dothan, Alabama. And the rest of my folks were grown up around the wiregrass country of Georgia, so I guess I qualify as a Southerner, and I live in Oklahoma and have for many years. I'm glad to be here tonight. I really am. I've heard about this place for a long, like my wife, I've heard about this place for many a year. And I've known that fella, Mr. Cook, for several years. And I thought, well, now surely when I get over here to North Carolina, I'll not know anybody else, because I just don't know anybody in that area of the country. I know Dave, and but I just wouldn't know anybody else. And when I was sitting there last night and I looked over and I pointed to that lady over there, and I says to my wife, I know that lady. I don't know where I know her, but I know that lady. Well, it turns out it was Edith, and Edith and I were on the same panel in 1975 and 76 at the General Service Conference in New York. So, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is a small place, and I'm extremely glad to be here. I heard a joke this afternoon. It was one of Dr. Marley's, and I thought it was kind of funny. I'll just share it with you because I like to do that. My wife hates for me to tell jokes. She says, you're rotten at telling jokes. Maybe I'll tell an Al-Anon joke. I don't know. But nevertheless, these people were sitting in this restaurant, and this lady, all of a sudden, a frog jumped up on the table and started talking to this lady. And the lady was shocked, and she looked at this frog, and the frog says, oh, don't mind me, lady. I'm just a talking frog, and I tell you what, my genie turned me into a frog, and if I could get a pretty lady to kiss me, why, then I would turn back into the Texas oil man that I really am. And so the lady just takes this frog and grabs it up and sticks it in her pocket and starts to walk away, and all the people at the table says, hey, wait a minute, why don't you kiss that frog? My goodness, she says, listen, a talking frog nowadays is worth a hell of a lot more than any Texas oil man. Is that okay, honey? Thanks, darling. Oh, gosh. I'm really glad to be here tonight. It's the one thing I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just love it, and that is the way we can laugh. You know, today we can laugh. I don't know about you, but when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was absolutely nothing funny in my life, and there wasn't anything to be laughing about. It was serious business, boy. And today I just love it when we can sit around and laugh at ourselves and all that. It's just, it's great fun. I'm one of these kind of guys that says, what if, you know, what if? Golly, that, I spent a lot of time with what if. And the thing is that I sometimes get into Alcoholics Anonymous, and as I'm around Alcoholics Anonymous a lot, I say, well, I wonder whatever happened to, and I think about the people that I've got sober with, you know. And you know, when I come to meetings like this and I see all of us, that a lot of your faces I don't know, but I know that by the mere fact that you're here, that I know about you and you know about me. You know, because I don't care what you look on the outside. I have learned that I don't have to judge that outside, because I know that you didn't get here to try to improve your social standing. I'll tell you that for sure. I think what you came here for was the same reason that I came here for, because we didn't have any place else to go. And, you know, it was, and we were hurting inside. You know, every time I think about that, I think that I know that in a gathering of this size, there's somebody out there tonight that's hurting inside. And you may have a few days, you may have a few months, or you may have several years. I don't know. But I know that you're hurting inside. And I know that that you're still here in Alcoholics Anonymous because you don't have any place else to go. But there's some things in Alcoholics Anonymous that we can do when we have that knot in our gut. and that is to share it with somebody else. And whether it does one thing, a single thing to change the outcome or the problem itself, I know this much. The beautiful part about Alcoholics Anonymous, it changes the intensity of it, and we can live with it a whole lot better. And if that one somebody is out there tonight, I want to talk to you tonight. That's the person I want to talk to. And the rest of you want to listen, that's fine. But that person out there is one who's trying and who wants the things we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, but is somehow not able to open up and let somebody else help share that. And you're the one I want to talk to because, see, I was that kind of person. I could not share anything with anybody. I had, by the way that I started my life, you know, I was one of these, I was one of four boys, and there was a girl in our family. We had five children in our family. And we were the kind of, we were poor. We lived on a farm. And my mother and father were alcoholic. And, boy, I hate, from the earliest memory, I just hated that farm. Oh, I hate, and I'd go into this little town of Edmond, Oklahoma, and I'd be called a country hick, and God, I hated being called a country hick. I just wanted anything in this world, and I'd get out there behind that dadgum mule, and I'd look down those rows, and I'd say, one of these days, I'm going to show them. I didn't even know who them was, but I was going to show them. And I dreamed of getting off of faraway places. I loved geography. That was one of the favorite subjects I had in school, you know. And I'd get up there, and my teacher would be putting up on the board all these different places, and you know. And then she started giving words, definition of words, and all that. And one day she put up there vagabond, the word vagabond, and she gave the definition for it. And I remember so well that I said, "Yeah, yeah, that's what I want to be, the vagabond." Little knowing that in years to come I was going to be just that. And you know, that I was a dreamer, and that's the way I started my life. And it didn't change a whole lot. As a matter of fact, I don't guess it's changed all that about my dreamer part anyway, but the difference between the dreams today is I can accept them as dreams, and then I can put reality on this side and dreams on the other side. And I got into Merchant Marine when I was 14. I lied about my age, and I went into the Merchant Marine before I was 15. I'd been overseas and torpedoed a couple of times, and it was just one of those things that I grew up fast. And I like to do what the big boys did. I'll never forget that my first drink of booze was when I was in this little town of Edmond, Oklahoma, and I was working in this restaurant, and we had 3-2 beer, and they had a bunch of GIs at the college there, and I was waiting on them, and they said, "Hey, Jim, you want a bottle of beer? I'll buy it for you." And I said, "Yeah, that'd be a good idea." And I drank that bottle of beer, and golly, I'd been watching my dad drink that stuff for years, and I didn't have any idea that I tasted it before, and it tasted terrible. But I just chug-lugged it down like they told me to that night. It took a little while, but boy, I knew then why they'd all been fighting and fussing over that stuff for so long. Golly, that was good stuff. So I had me another one, and I had me another one. And I lived about 3 blocks from that restaurant, and I remember walking up those stairs. They were very narrow stairs, and I was bouncing off the sides of them. And I got to my room, and I made a big mistake. I laid down flat on my back. And I want to tell you that the room began to spin, and all of a sudden, I just puked straight up about 4 feet. Just like a geyser. And, you know, the strange part about that deal was, I remembered then that, you know, I knew, well, that just must come along with it. It must come along with all those good feelings that it did for me, because it made me grow up in a hurry. I just automatically became a man, and I'd been wanting to be a man for so long. And so that's where it started. I puked the first time that I drank, and I puked the last time that I drank, and a long time of puking in between. I know there's some pukers out there. There's got to be some pukers out there. And if you're one of me, why, you know, I know exactly what your life was. And that's the way it started, and I tell you something, I had lots of, I had all the experiences that any other alcoholic had. I was given all of the good things that a young man in my day and time was given, you know, all of the right kind of advice and the bringing up. You don't lie, you don't cheat, you don't steal, and you work hard, and you go to school, and when you grow up, well, you get married, and you have a family, and you take care of the family, and I was given all those ideals. My parents were alcoholic, but they gave us the best. They did the best they could for us, and that's what I grew up with. And I know that during the time that my alcoholism progressed, that I got married, and one of the things that I was given was that, you know, if you're a real man, you don't hit a woman. That's just it. You just don't do it. And I knew that. Didn't even really have to be told that, but it was emphasized to me over and over again. And I remember that when I got into the stages of alcoholism, that I didn't have any idea what was, that one morning I woke up and my father, I was on one of my cycles then. You know, how, I don't know if any of you guys had cycles, but I had up cycles and down cycles. And I was on one of my down cycles, and the bad luck cycle, and I had to live in the rent house that my father and mother had out in the back, and we were living in that. And my father came out there and he looked at me, and I didn't like the look of you, and I didn't see my wife, and my dad said, and he looked with kind of a bad look. He said, "Well, I guess you're proud of yourself this time, aren't you, big shot?" And I didn't know what had happened, but I said, "What are you talking about, Dad?" He says, "Well, I guess you don't remember, huh?" I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, it seems you and your wife were out last night drinking, and when you came home, you started beating up on her. And she's over in St. Anthony Hospital over there, and she's over there because you twisted her leg so badly that they're having to remove the cartilage from her knee, and I guess you're real proud of yourself, aren't you, big shot?" God, I wanted to die. I just wanted to die. Because that was the cardinal sin, as far as I was concerned. You just don't do that. That's not something you do. And there I'd done it. And I went over there, and you know the funny thing about it was I had to get half drunk before I could even go over there and face that woman, because I just couldn't stand what I'd done. And I got over there, and with all the sincerity that I could possibly muster, and as you know, I met every word of it as far as I could at that point. And I told her, I said, "I'll never take another drink as long as I live, so help me God." And I meant every single word of that. Before midnight that night, I was drunk as I could be. And that's really, you know, that's when I said, how did you go through all this thing and then you're drunk again, you know? And I lived that kind of up and down cycle for so many years, so many years. Don't tell me that alcoholics don't have determination, boy. When you can live with that kind of stress all your life and that kind of guilt pounding at you day after day, we've got determination. But nevertheless, that's how it started out. And I, you know, it just continued from there. And then finally, I won't go through the whole boring drunkalogue, but you know where it was and how it started. And one day I woke up and I was in, I had gotten down to the point, I'd had lots of ups and down cycles in there. And I was in Los Angeles, California. I had run out there things were going to be better in California. For an Okie, you know they're better in California. And so I went to California. And the only problem was that I took me with me. And the same things began to happen. And I got out there and I met another lady. I have another problem that goes along with my alcoholism. It's called marriageitis. I used to get married a lot. I used to get divorced a lot. And I had lots of mother-in-law trouble. Now, I know none of you guys ever had any mother-in-law trouble, but I had lots of mother-in-law trouble. For about 6 months, they would think I was the greatest guy going. They'd just think I'd real great. And then after that, they learned what I was, and they said, "How did you pick out that bum?" You know, I mean, that's the way it was. Well, anyway, I got into this deal out there, and I went through these marriages, and I tried. I wanted to try, and I really did want to be a good husband, and I wanted to be a father, and I wanted to be all of these things. And I never was good at that. I had abandoned two kids in Oklahoma, and I was going to get a new start out there in California. And the only start came was when I got to the point where I couldn't stand me anymore. And I was into the... I woke up one morning, and I was in the Lancashire Hotel, a big luxury hotel at 7th and Broadway in downtown Los Angeles. I'm being facetious, of course. And I just couldn't stand me anymore. And I took a look at me, and I got up this morning, and I drank, and the big deal that happened that day was this. I got up scared to death, as I usually did. And I started drinking, and I couldn't, nothing happened. And I always had to drink when I got up in the morning. And I had a job where I could go and drink all day and all that sort of thing, as long as I could do my work. And I came home that night, and I was in terrible shape. And I couldn't understand why I was just scared to death, and I couldn't understand why this thing wouldn't work. And finally, about 2 o'clock in the morning, I just went over to the mirror, and I looked in the mirror, and I said, Shaw, you're as worthless as you can possibly be. Why in the heck don't you do this whole world a favor and just get rid of yourself? And so I thought, yeah, the more I thought about it, that's an excellent idea. And I was on the 7th floor of this hotel, and I got over to the window and got out on the ledge. And I don't remember a bit of fear. I do remember trying to think, this is it. You're going to have to think of something to say. You're going to have to think some kind of thoughts or something. And the only thing that I could think of was those two children that I'd abandoned in Oklahoma. And I thought, now you've been a rotten, worthless father all your life, and you're going to leave those two kids a suicidal father. Aren't you something? And I couldn't do it. So I came back in, and I had remembered that I'm also a thief, and I had remembered that while I was in jail, they had told me that I had a drinking problem, and that I ought to call Alcoholics Anonymous. And with all the dignity that a good self-respecting alcoholic could muster, I said, "Who, me? Go to those people to get help? You got to be kidding!" I had 30 cents in my pocket. I was facing a grand theft forgery charge, and I'm saying, "Who, me?" Right? And so I just didn't do it. But this night I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was nobody there, of course. So I just hung up. But the part where I think God came into play in my life, and I'm sure He did that before He'd let me jump off of that building. But the next day, I got up. I took the same amount of vodka. It did not do anything at all. And I went to work, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't ever want to forget that day, because that day was... I tell you the reason I don't want to forget it. I'm just so in love with the people that work our central offices or intergroup offices, and because of their dedication to it. I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was being professional, and I said, "I want to get some information for a friend." You know how that goes. And this lady knew who she was talking to, and so she started sharing a little bit of her story with me, and she kept on talking, and finally she began to draw me out a little bit, and she knew exactly what she was doing. And so she, I don't remember to this day what was said, but I do remember that I had gotten to talking, and I was explaining something that was going, that somehow I had gotten there, about my kids or some ridiculous thing, and this lady says, "Oh yes, I understand. You see, I'm an alcoholic too." And I don't know what sense that made to anybody, but all I had been, in the last few minutes while I was talking to her, had been a big lump getting closer and closer to my throat up here, and I was the kind of guy that never showed emotion. But this lady was getting to me, and all of a sudden when she said that, I said, and I just started bawling like a little baby. I just started bawling. And so she says, "Could I ask you a question? Could it possibly be that this person that you were calling for, could that possibly be you?" And I said, "Yes," and I started crying some more, and she let me cry, and I cried, when I settled down a little bit, why, she says, "Thank God. Thank God. Because if you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, we have the answers for you here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Won't you let me send someone out to talk to you?" Now, I'd already exposed myself much too much by that time. And so now I got to back off a little bit, and I got to be all that, go through all that stuff again, you know. And so I said, "Oh, no, I'm at work now. I couldn't possibly have anybody come out here and talk to me." And she just let me babble on for a little while. And then she says, "Well, could I have a male member of Alcoholics Anonymous call you?" I said, "Yes, here's my unlisted phone here at the office. He can call me here." Now, this office that I was talking about was a schlock jewelry store where I was the credit manager, you know. And so she, in about an hour, a guy by the name of Tom called. And he says, "My name is Tom. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Does anyone there have a problem with alcohol?" And I thought, well, I better answer this guy. He sounds kind of professional. Like, I better answer him pretty good. And so I said, "Yes, I think I've been an alcoholic for about the last 2 weeks." He said, Boy, I damn near busted out laughing with that one, Jim. And so we made arrangements to meet, you know, and that we were going to meet in front of my hotel at 5:30. And I was there, and there was about 40 or 50 people standing out in front of that hotel, catching buses and waiting for rides and that sort of thing. And they were standing out there, and the car whips around the corner. Two guys are driving, and Tom gets out over here, and he comes just directly out of that. I had a coat, suit, and tie on and everything. He comes directly out of there, and all those people stand out there, and he points his finger at me. He says, "Are you Jim?" I got my first resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous right there. I knew damn well I didn't look like an alcoholic. So Tom took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was getting in pretty bad shape by this time. See, I drank all the time, and I was allowed to where I was working. But I hadn't had anything to drink now since about 1:30. And I was getting quick, I mean, and it was just really getting bad, and the sweat was just rolling off. I mean, it was just coming off me, and I experienced during the next 2 hours some insanity that I didn't really know was in me at all, and it was not the way I conducted myself or anything else. It was just sheer insanity, but it all took place. Anyway, we got to this place, and I was really beginning to feel bad, I walked in there, and the smoke was just billowing. It was just a basement of a church over in Hollywood, and we walked in there, and it was raucous. The laughter was just going crazy, and I'm walking in there, and I thought, oh, my God, what is this place? And I saw all these signs around. There but for the grace of God. Let go and let God, and easy does it, and think, and that one really got me. And I went on, and there was all kinds of these signs. In my mind, you know, it was working real good about that time, and I said, I know what this is. My brothers are all preachers and deacons and all that sort of stuff. I know what this place is. This place is a holy roller place, and they're going to pray over me. By God, I've been tricked. And I started yelling at Tom, and I said, Tom, you've tricked me, by God. I know what all this crap is. You people are going to pray over me. And I just babbled on and on. And finally, Tom was a great big guy. And he says, Jim, shut up. And I was no shape to argue with Tom, I'll tell you that for sure. So I shut up. And then he says very gently, he says, Jim, for God's sake, please keep an open mind tonight. It just might mean your life. And so I did the best I could with what I had to work with about that time, you know. And I sat down and I got in there, and all of a sudden... They started the meeting, and it was one of these participation first and speaker after. And so I sat there, and all of a sudden this little girl gets up, you know, and I'm really not in good shape at all, and my mind is playing tricks on me. And all of a sudden she gets up there, my name is Susie, and I've been sober for 6 months, and life in Alcoholics Anonymous is just wonderful. And I just reached out, and I said, B.S., lady, it can't be that way. And they all looked at me, and they were shocked, and Tom looked at me and says, Jim, shut up. I says, yeah, okay. And I tell you, that was not the way I acted, but that's what happened that night. And the next guy that got up and says, my name is Paul, and I'm telling you, it's been tough. I've been sober for 4 months, and it's really tough out there, and this is a tough life. And I said, yeah, you're right, Paul, it sure is. And I just was yelling at him, and Tom turned around to me and says, Jim, if you don't shut up, we're going to have to throw you out of here. Well, after he said that, I kind of came back to my senses, but I knew I'd been out to lunch somewhere. You know, I really knew that I'd been crazy. So I shut up, and I listened to what was going on. And when that meeting was over with, he turned around, and he looked at me, and says, what'd you think, Jim? I said, man, I don't even know what I think, but I knew what I thought to myself. And the one thing that I picked up out of that whole thing was, you people were all supposed to be alcoholics, and yet you were laughing. And I caught myself laughing during that time. And that was something that attracted me. So I hope we in Alcoholics Anonymous never, ever forget that laughter and how important it is to us, to people especially who are new, who haven't had anything like I hadn't had anything to laugh about in a long time. Sure, we've got a serious program. Sure, we're serious about our sobriety. But we've got to take time to live and to have fun. And that laughter is so important. I really hope we never forget that. I kept going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know why, and I don't know how it all came about except with the help of God. I don't know where else I could have managed it, because I just let these guys tell me what to do. And I never let anybody tell me what to do. Absolutely no one ever told me anything that I accepted their direction and took it. And yet these people were telling me, I'll pick you up tomorrow night. We'll go to a meeting. And we've been going on for about a week like that, and one night I said, hey, how many of these meetings you got to go to? Oh, and he kind of grinned. He put on that real funny-looking grin that like they do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Says, oh, you got to go to meetings till you don't want to go to meetings, then you don't have to go to meetings, and then you want to go to meetings. And I said, what in the world is he talking about? And I said, oh, uh-huh. And so I kept on going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the way it started. And I'll tell you something. Those first days in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was scared to death all day long, except when I got into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a conscious thought in my head, they can't get to me here, at least for the next hour and a half. They cannot get to me here. And I didn't really know who they were. But I knew that I had all those problems out there, the IRS, I was facing a grand theft felony charge, and it was just a mess. And I was scared. I was scared to death. But I wasn't going to show you that. You know, I just come in and tell you how wonderful things were. Yeah, today went all right. You know, it was just inside, and I was going to keep it there. And I kept going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they started funny little things like, hey, you need to get a sponsor. I said, yeah, I'm going to get one of these. I'd been hearing that for ever since I'd been around. Yeah, I'm going to get one of these days, but, you know, I'll catch it down the line. And the more meetings I attend, more often it seemed to come up that, when are you going to get a sponsor, Jim? And, Jim, you got a sponsor yet? And I don't know, it just kept on with that. And one night I'm over in this meeting over in West Los Angeles, and I'm sitting there, and it was a big, long room about like this one, and we had tables and the discussion. It was a discussion meeting, and the door was over there, and we had tables that went all the way back. And I'm sitting way back there, and I'm sitting by a guy by the name of Byron, and we'd been kind of running together, and he says, Jim, you really do need to get a sponsor. A guy with the arrogance and the ego that you've got, gosh, you need a sponsor bad. And I said, yeah, I'm going to get one of these days. No, I'm serious, Jim. You really need to get one. And he kept on, he wouldn't stop the subject. And so he says, Jim, if you don't get one soon, you're going to get drunk. Now, then he got my attention. Because if there's anything, I didn't know what you people had, really. But I knew what I'd had, and I didn't want any more of that. And if there was something else different here to be had, then I wanted that. And so I heard what he said, and I said, yeah, all right, I'll get one soon. And just about that time, I had just kind of turned my head just a little bit, and then all of a sudden my head got back there, and boy, I got a elbow in the side there, and Jim, there's the guy you need for a sponsor. Now, I'd seen this guy around. I'd seen him around a lot, and he was a cocky little so-and-so, and gosh, I couldn't stand him. I hated him. He was just a real smartass, if you will. And I just couldn't stand it. He seemed like he wanted to be some kind of guru around there or something like that, you know. And I looked at Byron, and I looked at him, and I looked at Byron, and I looked at him. I said, you got to be kidding. I can't stand that little, much less ask him to be my sponsor. He said, that's exactly the reason you need that guy. A guy like you with the arrogance and the ego that you've got, he's the guy you need to have. I said, oh, my gosh. And so he just kept on. And finally I said, okay, I'll go at the coffee break, and I'll go talk to him. So at the coffee break, at his urging, he said, don't forget, go talk to him. And I went over there, and he was sitting at this table, and I walked over to him, and I just stuck my finger right in his face, and I said, listen, Clancy, I want you to be my sponsor. He looked up at me and says, you what? I said, I want you to be my sponsor. He got real quiet. A little bit, he looked up at me and said, listen, puke. People don't come around telling me I'm going to be their sponsor. They ask me, now you get the hell out of here and come back later, and maybe I will and maybe I won't. And I
drew up with all my dignity, and I went back to Byron. I said, "You see there, Byron, I went over there and I humbled myself." And he said, "You what?" He says, "Jim, go over there and ask that guy to be your sponsor, right?" So after the meeting was over, I went over and I said, "Well, Clancy, listen, I really would like for you to be my sponsor." And he says, "Well, that's a whole lot better." But he says, "I think there's a few things you and I need to talk about first." He says, I want you to understand that I don't give suggestions. I give directions, and I expect those directions to be followed." And he says, there's just certain things that everybody I sponsor that they have to do, and you're no exception." And he started naming the things that he wanted me to do. He says, "First of all, your time," and he took out his little wallet, and he says, "your time to call me every day is 10:06. And I don't mean 10:04 or 10:08. I mean 10:06, and that's what time I want you to call me." And he says, "And you will go to 7 meetings a week. I will pick them out. I'll tell you what to do when you get there." And he's telling me, and he's just going on with this list of things. "You will go in at least 30 minutes. You will be at the meeting 30 minutes beforehand. You will go in there and stand by the door. And everybody that comes in, you will say to them, 'Hi, my name is Jim, and I'm new.'" And I said, "You've got to be kidding." He says, "No, I'm not." And, you know, when he got through naming the list of things that he expected me to do, I heard the strangest noise coming out of my mouth that I ever heard in my life. I was saying to him, "Okay, I will." And I knew. And he put the funniest grin on his face after I said that. He says, "Oh, that's good, Jim." He says, "I like your attitude. Now, your first direction is, you see those two tables over there where we had crock cups and everything else at that time. We had to wash them and all that." He says, "You see those over there?" He said, "Those two tables over there, you go over there and tell those people that are washing, that are clearing off those two tables, to please leave all that stuff alone, that your sponsor has said that you should wash and dry them all by yourself." And I knew darn well I'd made a mistake right then. I just knew I had. So anyway, the next day, and he says, "By the way, I want you to call me and come down to my place tomorrow, the next day." And the next day, well, I went over there. And he says, "Now, Jim, we're getting down to serious business here. Alcoholics Anonymous is serious business. But," he says, "it is one that will save your life." And he says, "I want to tell you something. I know you've got lots of problems, and that's why I started my talk the way I did tonight, because I remember so well what he was talking about that night, that day." And he says, "I know you've got lots of problems." And I thought to myself, he doesn't know the half of it. Wait till I give him all of it, you know. But the facts are, and he says, "I know." And then he says, "Why don't we talk about a little bit about them?" And I just mentioned a few of them and off the top of my head. And he says, "Okay," he said, "let me say this to you. I want you to take all those problems you got and mentally take them and put them in a paper bag. And I want you to close that paper bag. I want you to hand it to me." And he says, "Later on down the line, we'll take those problems out one at a time and work on them. But," he says, "right now, I want you to just concentrate on staying sober, coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and learning to trust your fellow man. Because you don't trust anybody, Jim." And he says, "I want you to start with me. I will never betray your trust." And for a minute, I believed him, and I really wanted to bad. And then it was a little easier for me to believe as I began to digest that. And somehow or another, I really believed that I could trust that man. And so he started telling me about, you know, that what he wanted me to do, and that it was going to be okay. No matter how many problems I had, my life could change if I would but do what he suggested for me to do. And he says he wasn't going to be doing it just to have somebody to tell something to do, but to trust him that the things he told me to do would work in changing my life. And I needed to hear that. I needed to hear that bad. Because I really was, while I was going on the inertia of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no direction. And my life began to take direction at that time. And so I started on this path of taking direction in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I suggest to you, if you may be new out there tonight,
if taking direction is something that's abhorrent to you as it was to me, that you reconsider your viewpoint. Because it was after I reconsidered it that I began to do something and I began to have some improvement in my life. And so I kept going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and problems of all kinds were coming up in my life. Oh, it was just horrible. Those two children that I had back in Oklahoma, well, their mother's alcoholism manifested itself, and those children wound up in a foster home. And I thought, oh my God. So in my last stages of alcoholism, I had gone back there to get them and brought them back to California out of the frying pan and into the fire, and there they were. And they finally had to wind up going from my house to my brother's house in Arizona. And then when I got sober, my brother wanted to know what I was going to do with my kids. I didn't know what I was going to do with my kids. I was trying to keep from going to prison. I was trying to get myself readjusted. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I talked to my sponsor about it. And he says, Jim, we're going to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. That's what we're going to do about that problem right now. He says, those things are not something we can handle, that we can do anything about right this instant. And don't make them any bigger than they are. Tonight we'll go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought that was a crazy answer. I didn't think that made any sense at all. And yet I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And finally, what we had to do was that those children had to go in a foster home in Los Angeles. And I want to tell you something. I was not prepared for that. My pride and ego and everything else for my kids to go into a foster home was something else. And what worse yet happened in my mind, these children were put in a black foster home. And I thought, God, you're after me. You're just doing it to me. Why would you have that happen? And I just was furious about it. And I told my sponsor about it. And he says, there's nothing you can do about it right now, Jim. That's where they're going to have to go. You cannot take care of them and get sober too. You just are not mentally in shape to do it. You're barely able to take care of yourself. And he says, I promise you that if you'll work at it from that direction, that later on you can take care of those kids. And so I had to do that. And I went out there and I took those two children out there, and my daughter looked at me and she said, and the eyes, she didn't say a word, but her eyes told me, Daddy, you're doing it again. You're abandoning us one more time. And I just had to turn around and run because I was, you know, just about to bawl. The strange thing was that when I came back the next week, the one thing my sponsor had told me, he says, Jim, the one thing you can do for them is to let them know you're there, and you go out and visit them every week. And that way, they'll know you're there, and keep in touch by phone. And I did all that. The next week, I went out there, and my daughter came running up to me, and she was just tickled to see me, and my son, too. And they were just starting to tell me how wonderful they were being treated, and they were so glad that if they had to go to a foster home, that they had, this was the one they had to come to, because the lady had been so nice, and the man had been just treated them wonderful. And I thought, you know, at that time, I knew that one thing had happened. I knew that one more time my prejudices and my judgment was not what I believed it really was. It was not good. It was not valid. And so I'm happy to tell you that that lady, Leo, Betty and Leo Wilder, and by the way, they live back here now in this state of North Carolina. And they took care of those kids, and they've been included in everything, in their graduations and all of the proms and all of this other thing. And you know, one of the experiences that Alcoholics Anonymous started teaching me very early, that one right there, told me that you have to keep an open mind, that I had to keep an open mind. And today, whenever it comes to judging anybody, the color of their skin doesn't make a darn bit of difference. It really does not. And you know something else? There's a guy back in Norman, Oklahoma. His name is Calvin Nichols. Calvin's about 6'2", and Calvin is a black guy. And I sponsor Calvin, and I've sponsored Calvin for almost 3 years now. And he is such a pleasure to work with. And Calvin came to me in a very strange way. My business that I had at that time was AA Rentals. And he had called Alcoholics Anonymous, and he'd gotten my number. And he just started talking. He says, my name is Calvin,
And he says, I really think I need to be in some kind of forced program because I just can't seem to stop drinking. And I said, we have a place for you. Why don't you come on down? And so we got together, and when he walked in, Calvin was there. And I saw that same look in Calvin's eye that I knew I had in my eye. And I knew it didn't make a damn bit of difference if he was black or if he was green or if he was yellow or what he was. That he needed help, and I was there. So I took Calvin to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Calvin's a hell of a guy. Calvin's a big part of that meeting today. He's a leader in our group. And I love Calvin without condition today. And that's a fantastic deal. That's part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept on going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous out there, and my sponsor kept making me do things that never made any sense whatsoever. And somehow or another, he says, your judgment's not valid. Mine is. What do you mean? It got me this far. He says, yeah, your best judgment got you to that 12-step house over in Beacon Street. That's exactly where your best judgment got you. And he would cut me down. And I didn't know that he was cutting out this ego that the book talks about. You know, the ego had to be smashed. And he was doing a good job. He was busting on that ego with a sledgehammer lots of times. And I used to get so mad at him. One time I got a hold of him, and I had him by the shirt, and I was just going to turn loose on him. And I saw fright in his eyes because I was insane. And he says, Jim Jaw, you crazy SOB, turn me loose. And somehow or another, he got through to me. And after that, I said, I'm really sorry. He said, yeah, I know, you crazy. And he went on, you know. But the thing was that even with all that kind of thing, whenever I needed him, he was there. When I was about 4 months sober, one night I was in this 12-step house, and I'd just come from a meeting, and all of a sudden, the darndest bunch of fear that I ever felt in my life just totally enveloped me. I was sitting there in the day room wanting to go upstairs and go to sleep, and I was just scared. And the more I sat there, the worse it got. The more I sat there, the worse it got, and it just seemed to expand. And about 2 or 2:30 in the morning, it just seemed like my head was going to blow off, and I was scared to death, and I called him. Because he had told me, he says, Jim, if you ever need me and you're not drinking, you call me. I don't care what time of the day it is. So I called him. I said, Clancy, this is Jim. And I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'm scared to death. I mean, really scared. And he thought for a minute, and he says, okay, Jim, I'll tell you what I want you to do. I want you to go outside. I want you to take a walk around the block. I want you to come back in. I want you to call me again. And I said, Clancy, I can't even make it to the front door. He said, okay. He said, you sit down in that chair by the telephone, and I'll be there in 15 minutes. Now, I was in the MacArthur Park area of Los Angeles, and he lived in Santa Monica. In 15 minutes, he was walking up that step. And when he walked in there, I just started crying, and I just started sobbing. And he put his arm around me and says, come on, Jim, we'll go take that walk together. And we left, and we walked, and we walked, and we went out of there, and we walked, and we walked way up Bill Wilshire Boulevard and back again. And we just walked, and we sat in the park for a long time, and he started telling me about his insanities and the way he had felt when he was new and about my age and sobriety. And he says, Jim, it's okay to feel crazy, but you did the right thing. You called me, and now we can get this thing together. We can work it out. And we walked, and we walked, and we walked, and finally, we were just about back to the 12-step house, and I looked over, and the sun was coming up. Just beginning to come up, sun up. And he looked at me, and he says, you're doing okay now, aren't you, Jim? I said, yeah, I'm doing fine now, Clancy. He says, I don't ever want you to forget this night. Because, you see, someday, somehow, you're going to share this with somebody else. They're going to have the same problem, and you'll know what's going to happen with it. And would you know that at least 3 different times that same thing has happened, that I've been people working with people and that same, and I've been able to share in the same fashion that that man shared with me. God, that's not Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what it is. One of us sharing with another one. And we don't have any real insights that are so wonderful and all that, but we can take that load and help carry it. And we can share that, yeah, we know we can get on through that thing. Yes, it's gray, it's black, it's dark right here. But on the other side is some light. And that's what we have to offer. That's really all we have. And I think that experience of ours that's so valid is the greatest gift that God gave us to give another alcoholic. Anyway, that kind of thing went on in my life. And I'm a great one on sponsorship. I believe in sponsorship. Today I am privileged to work with a number of people. And that's a great part of my life. I've been working, we live in Norman, but I've been working in Dallas for the last 3 months. I'm coming home on weekends. About a month and a half ago, I knew that there was something not right in my life. I'm working with a lot of guys in Norman and all that sort of thing, and I've been going to meetings in Dallas and, you know, doing that sort of thing, but I could not, there was just something missing. And finally one day it popped in my head. You're not working with anybody. That's what's wrong. You're not working one-on-one with somebody. And that's what you've always done. That's what's wrong with you. So I looked around that group right there. I said, wonder if somebody needs to have somebody to work with. And so I nabbed me one. And he was, you know, and it started out. Now I got three in Dallas, you know. That's the way it is. And it's necessary for me. I got to tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know what the direction was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know where you were supposed to be at a certain time. You know, I always got into that thing. And as my sobriety went along, I got more and more, I realized that, when does all this wonderful stuff start to happen, you know? Well, what happened was I got married again. I'm not knocking the institution to marry, I promise you that, but the thing was that I had just two sick people trying to get along and couldn't make it, you know. And I had to go through a divorce in Alcoholics Anonymous, and boy, I hated that. Because I said to Clancy, I went to my sponsor, I said, can't even be successful in Alcoholics Anonymous in a marriage. What's wrong with me? And he said, I don't know what's wrong with you, Jim, but he said, I'm going to tell you this. I want you to go to a marriage counselor. I said, a marriage counselor? He said, yeah, I want you and Judy to go to a marriage counselor. I said, well, we've got the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's in the program. Says, I want you to go to a marriage counselor. Well, you know the answer. I went to a marriage counselor. And I went to this marriage counselor for almost a year. And the funny thing was that I was having a hard time with my children, not hers. There were two of hers and two of mine. And I wouldn't have any problem with hers. I was having it with mine because they were acting crazy. And they were they'd turn into teenagers. And I had no training to try to, you know, to be equipped to handle kids, you know. So this marriage counselor said, Jim, you really have a problem with your kids, don't you? I said, boy, I do. And you would too if you had my kids, I promise you. And he says, well, let me ask you, and I was a dictator, and I was just a disciplinarian, and, you know, you do this, and you do this, and if you don't do this, I'm going to do this, and blah, 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 you know. And he says, Jim, let me ask you to try something. Try being their friend rather than their father. Just forget you're their father and try to be their friend. Try that you as you would treat somebody you sponsor or somebody. And I said, no, you don't want me to do it the way I sponsor people. He says, well, try to do it with somebody that's just a friend of yours then. So I did. Funny thing happened. Those kids started straightening up, and I could not believe what was going on around there, you know. One day I saw myself out there on that football field, and there was this gal coming across the football field, and she had this crown on, and she had a bunch of these ladies in attendance, and that was my daughter, and she was the homecoming queen, and God, I felt a pride like I never even knew that you could have, and it wasn't one of those dangerous kind, you know, that we alcoholics come up with. It was just a good, glowing pride in being able to be grateful and happy for my daughter. And that was a hell of an experience, and I want to tell you something new. I wouldn't have had it without Alcoholics Anonymous. I just wouldn't have had it. Because of the things that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous allowed that thing to come about. And my son became captain of his golf team, and he went into the Navy, and he got honorably discharged, which is not too bad, you know. I don't know, life just seemed to go on, and... I got a call, and just before I had the honor of being the delegate from Southern California Assembly Area, that same year, or that same right in that same time period, I got a call from my brother Bill back in Oklahoma, and he says, Jim, I got to tell you something. You know, my mother died of alcoholism
when in June of 1966, cirrhosis of the liver. And I came to the program in, I mean, she died in February, and I came in June and of 1966. And my father, I got a call. My dad was a drunk as well, and my brother called me and says, Jim, if you want to see your dad alive, you better get back here, because it looks like he's going to die this time. Now, my dad had been out to visit me in California, and when he came out there, he didn't drink. And he'd come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew he liked being at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew he was identifying. But he'd once in a while, he'd even sneak his hand up and get it down real quick if he thought I was looking or something like that when he asked for alcoholics, you know. So, but I went back in this hospital, and I was all the way back. I asked God to give me some words, you know, to talk to my dad with, because I don't know what to say. And when I walked into that hospital, I looked at my dad, and he looked horrible. He looked like he was going to die. He was bloated and everything. And I looked at my dad, and I said, Dad, I just want to tell you something. I came back here because I wanted to tell you how much I love you. You've been to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with me, and you know what it's done in my life. But, you know, I can't criticize you. Your life is your life, and you must do what you've got to do, but I just want you to know how much I really love you. And with that, I just had to turn around and walk off. And probably one of the greatest days of my life was a year later, on April the 4th, when I was able to call back to Oklahoma City and wish my 79-year-old father happy number one AA birthday. And I want you to know that my father died last March, and he had, within 3 weeks of 10 years sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know where you'd get that kind of gift except in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know where it's possible. But my dad, the thing that he gave me that day when I called him on his first birthday, he says, but Jim, don't you understand? It was your example that allowed me to get sober. And I had to sit there and cry. Because my example, the guy that was, you know, needed, had nowhere else to go and stumbled into Alcoholics Anonymous because of God's grace. And then was an example to my father so that he could, in his twilight years, have 10 years of sobriety. And he went to 5 meetings a week every week. He just, and he was secretary of the senior citizens group back there, by golly. I loved my dad. And, you know, that was a gift that you people gave me that, you know, how can I, you know, tell you how much it means? Just meant everything. And then my brother-in-law came into Alcoholics Anonymous after that. And then my wife told you about my daughter calling. Then my son calls me up one day and he says, Dad, how are you? Well, fine, son, how are you? My son's a cop with the Huntington Beach Police Department. And he said, well, guess where I was last night? I said, don't have any idea. He says, well, I was over at a place over on Sunset Boulevard, a synagogue out there. Is that a fact? Well, I spent a little time out there myself. He says, yeah, and I was there for the same reason that you went out there. And I don't know. He's got 9 months now. 9 months of sobriety. And our home is an Alcoholics Anonymous home. Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous home. I'm telling you, there are alcoholics and Al-Anon running in and out of that place all the time. And sometimes it gets a little hectic around there. And sometimes I say, geez, why don't they all go home? Because the problem is they all have problems at one time, you know. And then, and I know some of you have experienced some of that. But I wouldn't change 15 cents worth of it, you know. And Alcoholics Anonymous is so precious to me. It just is, it's just one of the greatest things on earth. I think we have an impact on this earth, too, that, you know, God put us here for a reason. I truly believe that. I sometimes wonder whatever happened to some of the stuff that went on when I was sober, though. I got to tell you that for sure, when I first got sober. You know, I don't hear about anymore about people. First thing I hear when they want to go on a 12-step call, they want to send them over to a treatment center. Or they want to, you know, they want to go put them in the hospital here. What the hell ever happened to having one puke on you and letting them sleep on your couch, you know? God, when I was first sober and I got that first apartment of mine, there was somebody sleeping on my couch all the time, puking on my floor and all this sort of thing. And
you know, that was kind of hectic when they did that. But I tell you what paid off. When I sat there and I watched those same people getting up there and getting that first birthday cake, God, there was just some kind of feeling inside that I had a little part to do with that. I had a little piece to do with that, and that's a good feeling. That's a good feeling. I don't see that happening a lot today, and I'm concerned about it. I really am concerned about it. I'm concerned that Alcoholics Anonymous, I see so much of the, and I'm not, I don't care where, if an alcoholic comes to Alcoholics Anonymous looking for help, my obligation as an alcoholic and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is to see to it that that person gets that help. And I don't care if they come from a treatment center or from Skid Row or from down in the gutter or what it is. But what I am concerned about it is the one-on-one contact. That's what my real concern is. And I hope that we don't dilute our effectiveness by getting all affiliated with a whole lot of other things. I hope that we stay non-affiliated. And that's the way I feel about things. And I'm very protective of Alcoholics Anonymous because, you see, it's one of the greatest thing in my life. I just see so many things that have happened to us, and when I get concerned, I just know that I have to sit back and I say, wait a minute, God's here too. And God's going to let Alcoholics Anonymous stay around just as long as it needs to be around. But my part is that I've got to do the footwork and I've got to be a responsible part of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this thing to me is kind of like the old captain of a paddle wheeler going up the Mississippi. There was this passenger on board there, and she kind of sidled up over to the captain and says, Captain, this is an awfully big river, and this is just a huge body of water, and I get a little nervous being out here on it, and do you know where all the rocks and all the sandbars and all the pitfalls are? The old captain very knowingly turned around and looked at her and says, no, I don't know where they all are, but I know where the channel is. And, you know, likewise in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think that we don't know where the pitfalls are in our lives. I don't think we'll live long enough to know where they all are or what they are. But there's one thing that I'm confident that I can do. I can stay within that safe channel of living called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope we'll all stay here together. Thank you all very much.
On behalf of the committee, we wish for you to accept this with our appreciation.
Thank you very much, Fulmer.
And you did exactly what Dave told you. You stayed within about an hour.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Wonderful. Harry has asked that the choir please convene here 20 minutes after we conclude the meeting. And we'll close by the usual manner, please.
Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who